Our session facilitators are on the line, so I'm going to swap the view over and add in a spotlight to Kent Glover, who will be providing opening comments today. Kent, I'm going to call up your materials and turn the floor over to you.
Thank you. Welcome to session two of the spring 2022 meeting of the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable. And the topic, as it shows here, is the application of robotics, machine learning, and artificial intelligence technologies to site remediation. So to get us started, I'd just like to go back and give a short recap of session one, which was last Monday, and we'll then introduce today's topics and speakers. Slide two, Gene, please. Thank you. So artificial intelligence technologies are transforming how people and machines work together by providing access to dangerous toxic environments and improving worker safety and making it possible to process and analyze large data sets in new ways. Roughly a year ago, leaders from several FRTR member agencies identified robotics, machine learning, and artificial intelligence technologies as an important need and an opportunity where FRTR could make a meaningful contribution to advancing technologies for cleanup of waste sites. Specifically, the agencies needed to share information and advances in artificial technology and understand how to apply artificial intelligence technologies to site cleanup. And so that brings us to our meeting objectives for this semi-annual meeting. Gene, slide three, please. Three listed here. I won't read them to you, but basically it's we want to review recent technology advances for site characterization remediation, identify potential benefits, risks, and limits of robotics and aerial systems to support our missions, and discuss appropriate use of machine learning and artificial intelligence for remediation decisions. Last Monday, we focused in on advances in robotics and unmanned systems to support characterization and remediation. And today, we'll be talking about advances in processing large data sets and machine learning. Last Monday, several speakers, five speakers, in fact, shared their experiences, project results, and equally important, their perspectives on advancing and using robotics and unmanned systems. Several speakers discussed recent advances in technology for accessing dangerous or toxic environments and improving worker safety. Other presentations focused on emerging technologies for collecting and analyzing data at new spatial and temporal scales to improve understanding of site conditions. Next slide, please. Our first speaker last Monday was Anthony Abreu. He provided a discussion of remote sensing, geophysical, and other non-invasive technologies for characterizing and monitoring disposal cells that the DOE manages. He is having good success using technologies to understand erosional features as a basis for making operational decisions. Next slide, please. Our second presentation described potential uses of drones and robotics for radiological sites based on comparisons of traditional data and data from small unmanned aircraft systems. Commercially available technology may be useful for detection of radionuclides at levels sufficient to support decommissioning. Next slide, please. Dr. Jason Wheeler provided an interesting presentation summarizing work that Sandia National Labs and a consortium of other universities and laboratories are doing to evaluate wearable robotics and exoskeletons to improve worker safety. And the intent of this work is to understand how exoskeletons can reduce risk of injury, basically. So let's go to the next slide. And then after a break, Ramona Irie and Martin Briggs from the USGS provided an overview of a project that they are conducting to demonstrate and validate a toolbox of robotics and unmanned systems for high-resolution mapping of groundwater discharge locations along streams. And, the tools are particularly adaptable for real-time characterization efforts in remote areas and can be used with dye dilution tests to quantify groundwater inflow to streams. And next slide, please. So our final presentation of session one was provided by Susan Thornlow. And I apologize for the typo in her name on this slide. That's my doing. Susan discussed using drones and a range of remote sensing technologies to measure emissions at landfills. She described using these types of data collection platforms in combination with statistical analysis to identify emission hotspots and spatial distribution of emissions. And this summer, she'll be working with a team of vendors to identify and validate technology. And with that recap, I want to introduce Jean-Pablo, my tongue is tied, J.P. Pabon. J.P. serves as a program manager with the Technology Development Office in the U.S. Department of the Office of Environmental Management, and he's tasked with pursuing the development of innovative technologies to improve workforce safety and complete the cleanup mission. Prior to his current assignment, J.P. provided independent oversight of DOE, EM, capital assets and operational activities. JP also is a DOE representative to the FRTR steering committee and has played a big role in scoping this spring meeting and webinars and identifying several of the speakers and presentations that we will be hearing both today and last Monday. And I'm very grateful for the time and energy and guidance that he's provided. And with that, I want to turn the microphone over to JP, who will describe the focus day's presentations.
Thank you, Ken, for that introduction. So today we're going to hear five presentations on advanced in processing large data set and machine learning for remediation decision support. And that wording of decision support is really important for DOE. So our first speaker is Carol Edick-Dillick. She is a senior technical advisor at Savannah River National Laboratory. For the past 25 years, she has worked on a variety of programs focused on development and deployment of innovative approaches and tools for environmental characterization and remediation, specifically the design and optimization of phase characterization strategies that can be applied to complex and challenging environmental. Since 2002, she has been the technical lead for the Technical Assistance Program at the Savannah River National Laboratory, providing technical support to the DOE complex. Currently, she's the lead for the DOEM Multi-Lab Artemis project focused on development of a new paradigm of long-term monitoring of environmental waste site based on state-of-art technologies to improve effectiveness and robustness while reducing overall costs. Today, she will be talking about the Artemis project, her presentation title, the DOE Artemis project, combining innovative technologies to improve long-term management of radionuclide contaminated sites. Welcome, Carol. With that, the floor is yours, Carol.
Okay, this is Carol. Thank you, JP, for the introduction. I am not a person who does AI machine learning kinds of technologies. I'm a person who has spent the last 30 years trying to solve DOE's environmental problems, especially with related to soil and groundwater contamination. And as part of my job, I go up to DC every couple of months and sort of have a few meetings and I walk the hallways. And two or three years ago, I was walking down the hallway and they had cleaned out a large suite in the Forrestal building and it was the new Office of Artificial Intelligence. So I walked into the office and I was just asking if maybe we could make an appointment to talk about our Altimus project, which is essentially focus on advancing the strategies for long-term monitoring of complex environmental sites. And I walked in and the person in the sort of receptionist took me and started talking to me. And the next thing I knew, I was in the office talking to the director. And we spoke for about an hour and a half about the project. And I said, well, you know, thanks for your time. I just wanted to sort of let you know what we were working on. And he said, no, thank you. At this point, you have the only active project within DOEM that is using AI machine learning techniques. And I said, well, that's nice and everything, but what we're really doing is we're solving a need for the DOE. So I'm going to take a little step back from it and then talk about how we're using these techniques to, sort of move forward. So this is a multi-lab, multi-agency project, and I'm going to give credit to everyone involved on the project on the last slide. But this is actually a slide that was put together by one of my collaborators, Haruko Wainwright at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. And it's a question of, if we take a step back, what is DOE's environmental legacy? And so if you look at the work that was done, there was initial work that was done sort of in the Southwest at the sites where they mined the uranium ore and then essentially removed the uranium from the leach, the uranium from the ore, and then sent it off. And then essentially there were places where plutonium was being produced at Hanford and Savannah River. There were enrichment facilities at Paducah and Portsmouth, lithium at the Oak Ridge National Lab. And so here's sort of an idea of essentially, where sort of the main factors were. But in actuality, there were over 100 sites that were involved in this effort moving forward. So 30 years later, where do we stand? We started with 100 sites. The Office of Environmental Management is down to 16 sites. The other sites have either been turned over to other agencies, released, or to the Office of Legacy Management that is responsible for managing them. And legacy management has some sites where there's still uranium complex plumes associated with uranium in groundwater. And basically, these are very large. The remaining residual plumes are very large. They're very complex. And we've gotten them down. We've treated source areas. We've reduced concentrations of contaminants in these plumes. But the treatment of low concentration plumes has been really, really challenging. And so recently there was a GAO audit of EM's liability for environmental cleanup across the country. They expect that legacy is going to exceed $550 billion to clean up the residual contamination and then provide long-term monitoring for the upcoming decades to make sure that the sites are still not releasing contaminants to the environment. So this project actually started about 6-8 years ago. It's kind of iffy up there. And the Office of Technology Development within Environmental Management is sponsoring this project. It's SRNL led, and we have at one of our sites, we picked one of our complex radionuclide plumes, and we're actually setting up a test bed. And so we've gone out to the National Lab Network and identified technologies that we can use in a holistic way to essentially monitor this plume. So essentially, this plume is a test bed. And what we're in the process of doing is identifying where we need to monitor now and into the future, and devising a comprehensive monitoring strategy moving forward that will essentially robustly monitor these plumes at a reduced cost. So here's essentially a listing of the labs and sort of the responsibilities as part of the project. Savannah River is developing an overall closure strategy. We're doing most of the geochemical characterization. We're responsible for this installation of all the sensor components and design for the technology demonstrations. Lawrence Berkeley is bringing a variety of sensors and modeling to the site, and then support as far as artificial intelligence and machine learning systems to essentially manage the large amounts of data that we're going to be bringing into the system, and interpreting that data and predicting essentially what is going to happen on the system as we move through time. PNNL is providing electrical resistance tomography to monitor the Cap'n Basin. And then Florida International and CRESP and other universities are providing watershed monitoring support and some other additional techniques to handle the data. So here is essentially our test bed. And the thing about the large complex plumes in the DOE complex is they're very well understood at this point. We understand which contaminants, how the contaminants are moving through the system. And what we really need to know is we need to have early indicators that the plume is behaving in a different way than we've predicted. Most of these plumes have essentially been moved from active remediation to an enhanced attenuation strategy. And so what we're actually monitoring may be a little different than we did in the beginning, but they will require continuous monitoring over the course of the next several decades. So here we have Savannah River F Basin, the low-level radioactive waste was discharged into these three basins from 1955 to 1988. Discharges were discontinued in 1988. The basins were capped and closed. In 1997, they instituted a pump and treat system where essentially they pumped from lines across through the below the high concentration parts of the plume. The water was treated, and then the water was re-injected up gradient because it contained tritium. And so the idea is to just keep re-injecting the tritium until we get to two or three half-lives, and then we're good. It turned out the pump and treat system was really expensive, and so we looked at an enhanced attenuation remedy. And so we installed a funneling gate system in 1997, in 2004, where essentially what we did, and they get annoyed at me when I say it, but basically we took large diameter augers and we augered kitty litter into the ground in a series of zones where the concentrated parts of the plume were. And then we left little openings in the wall. So basically what we're doing is we're funneling all of the contaminant water through the system through these gates. And then essentially what we can do is we can implement treatment strategies for the plumes. So basically, the treatment strategy is a base injection where essentially the plume is highly acidic. And so if we inject base and raise the pH from about 2 to 5, we can stabilize uranium and the other cations. We also have iodine in this plume, which is an anion. And so up gradient of the treatment system at the walls, we're injecting silver chloride to attenuate the iodine to silver iodide. And so this is a system that's working. It's working well. And what we need to know is that it continues to work and is going to continue to work over time. So this is a little bit different than the other talks, because a lot of the other talks that you had last week were essentially different technologies. What we've done is we've developed an integrated strategy that is essentially going to monitor this complex plume over the next 25 to 30 years. We're using the sensor and remote monitoring strategies because basically most of the monitoring historically has been done on samples of groundwater from wells. And if you actually are measuring a change in the groundwater in wells, you're too late. The change has already occurred. So by doing these sensors and identifying controlling variables for this plume movement, then if we note that the controlling variables are shifting, then we can go in and be proactive and figure out what's going on and stop the plume movement. And the other thing is that it doesn't sound like this is a lot cheaper, but it is indeed at Savannah River. At FRE alone, we monitor over 100 wells quarterly, and the cost per well is about $3,000 to $5,000. Doesn't sound like a lot until you add it up for 25 to 30 years, and then it's a tremendous amount of money. And then the another aspect of the project is to increase the robustness of future monitoring. When I first started, I was naive, and I thought, you know, in 1988, that basically these plumes were in the ground, they would move through and they would just move out of the system. But that is not what happened. As the chemistry of the groundwater changes, things attenuate, things move around. And so what we can do is we can predict both the evolution of the plume, but also the impacts of climate change on these plumes as they move through the ground. We're working at improving regulatory and stakeholder communication to essentially say, this is what we're doing. Even though there's residual contamination in the ground, it's still safe, and we're right on top of monitoring it. And the hope is once we get this test bed set up and we interact with our regulators and our stakeholders, that then we can work to sort of transfer this approach to DOE's other complex plumes with their site-specific remedies. So what are the vulnerabilities of this system? So Miles Denham is part of our team, and he identified this concept of zones of vulnerability. Where are the contaminants remaining in the system? Where are we attenuating them, or where haven't they moved? So at this system, we have vulnerable contaminants in the basin soils and in the vadosome below the basins. We've created a secondary source by treatment with the base injection and the silver chloride at the treatment zones in the gates. And because we didn't install the gates sort of halfway through the plume movement, there's a lot of attenuation of the contaminants in the wetlands where they come up to the stream. So I actually went back and I looked it up. In 2012, we had the team that's working on this thing, and we sat down. So we had this idea to sort of start using sensors. And so we decided, what are the master variables that actually control the plume movement? And we sat down and we had like 30 to 50 plots on these 11 by 17 pieces of paper. And we had like 30 back and front and back sides. And we sat down as a team for like 5 or 6 hours in a room trying to figure out what they were. And our answer after looking at all of this data on paper was groundwater level. And one of the things I've found out from all the years of helping with this DOE sites is groundwater always flows downhill. The water level is the driving forces. People forget it. And one of the things, if you're looking at a complex plume, you can control what's happening in your area. You can't control what's happening up gradient. You can't control groundwater level changes and things like that. So that is the major plume migration master variable. And then the chemistry is a little bit different. Here's the uranium, and it just shows EH and pH here, all the different species. Some of them are soluble, some of them are insoluble, that can happen. This plume started at pH 2, background concentration, pH 5. So a lot can happen here. So about 2016, there was a big reactive monitoring project where essentially they were developing reactive flow and transport models for each one of the DOE sites. And I met Haruko at that point, and she came in and we talked about this project, and she was really, really excited. So she did some of the initial machine learning work to look at the data, and she came up with specific conductivity and water level as the controlling variables. So we decided to let her into the project, and it's been a great collaboration ever since. So here's the conceptual model of the site. Here's the cross section. We have the basin, essentially the residual contamination there. The groundwater plume moves down. There's a clay, sort of broken clay layer that is the boundary condition at the bottom of the plume. Here is the treatment wall where we're injecting the amendments, and then the water flows through up into the wetland. And so we've identified the three zones of vulnerability below the caps and basins where the original materials are still present, and we don't want leakage through that basin that would drive the contaminants deeper. The subsurface barrier treatment zones, uranium and strontium, are attenuated there, and that's fine, but it may be with the groundwater flow, maybe we have some acidic parts of the groundwater coming in, and maybe that will be released. Iodine is very complex, and so we need to show that the silver iodide is stable. And then the wetlands, the plume moved through there for 15 to 20 years before we even started treating it. There's a thick organic layer. A lot of stuff is attenuated there. So here are the factors that essentially control the contaminant attenuation: water flow. What is the contaminant chemistry? What happens as pH and EH changes? What is the groundwater chemistry? How does that going to evolve? And what is the aquifer mineralogy that can interact with these contaminants? So I'm just going to quickly go through what we think are the risks associated in each one of these areas. And then I'm going to let Tom and Amanshu talk about the sensor network that we've essentially devised and we're in the process of installing right now. So the first zone of vulnerability is essentially the low permeability cap. We're concerned with groundwater flow through that cap that can precipitate down into the vadose zone and into the plume. And so we've decided on a technology in electrical resistant tomography, and we're installing just a electrodes on a portion of the cap to see how that functions. The monitoring treatment of the gates, we're going with a sensor network. What are the factors that control it? Well, I talked a little bit about it, the contaminant chemistry. So, you know, strontium, here's EHPH. For strontium, it's pretty simple. Iodine's a little bit more complicated. Here's uranium. It's very complicated, and, you know, we can work it out, but we need some sort of help with sort of understanding the data that's going to essentially come out. Slide. The second part of this is the groundwater chemistry. As I said, right now the pH of the groundwater plume is 2. The background pH is 5.5 to 6.5, promotes the continued absorption of strontium 90 and uranium in the treatment zones. We need to monitor pH at the perimeter and up gradient of the treatment zones to make sure that we're not getting acidic water into the system. And we think that will be pretty proactive. So here's the sensor network they laid out. This is what Tom's going to talk about. I distinctly remember I told him I had enough funding for like 9 sensors, and I think we're up to 27 sensors. But it's pretty robust. But basically, the blue is mostly focused on measuring the water level, so the driving forces. And then the orange sensors will be more focused on the contaminant chemistry. The wetlands were, Tom and I are actually at Lawrence Berkeley Lab today. We're having a meeting to do the final design for the sensor networks at the wetlands. The wetlands are very, dynamic. The seeps at the wetland change in location, move up and down the stream. We have the potential for erosion and the soil moves around. We have biological effects. We have seasonal effects. And we have two aquifers, and basically the upper and the lower aquifer come together in the seep line. We have thick concentration. We have thick, the upper levels of sediment or organic and they attenuate it. We need to make sure if those contaminants are released, that they're released in a slow manner, not in a large flood. And it turns out that our regulatory point of compliance is actually the seep line surface water. So this is a very important part of the long-term monitoring strategy. So with that, I'll stop talking. This is the long list of collaborators on the project. The intent is this summer to essentially install the complete monitoring network. And then Tom and Amanchu and others will manage the data and do the interpretation using these updated AI techniques. And I think that's all I have.
All right, thank you so very much. We did have some questions that came in regarding the timeline for the work and if you had follow-on projects, if you had seen any preliminary results where you think you might do something, sort of an offshoot project based off of what you've seen so far.
Actually, we do. And one of the things Tom is going to talk about is several of the other projects that we've used this strategy for. One of the issues at Oak Ridge National Lab is that they're D&Ding several of the mercury buildings. And basically, they're having trouble predicting mercury vapor concentrations in the air. And so what we're doing is we've designed a monitoring strategy to essentially identify those controlling variables and look at concentrations through time so they can understand it better. We also have another project associated with coal ash piles. Coal ash piles are very common in the US. Office of Fossil Energy reached out to us and asked us to look at one of our sites and essentially see if we could sort of devise a new monitoring system that they could use to monitor contaminant flux in those situations.
All right, our next question, have you used nanotechnology or an organic metallic framework compound to adsorb contaminants?
We have not. And one of the things we try to do at Savannah River is we have this strategy where we essentially go in, we evaluate the problem, we look at the problem. Sometimes the issue is maybe the expensive nanotechnology will get you 5 or 10% more attenuation, for example. But we try and do sort of lower costs. We know we're not going to get all of the contamination. There's so many different variables in these systems. And if we can inject something as simple and as low cost as base, then we'll essentially go with those remedies. It may be that we need to look at some of the nano strategies for the seep line iodine attenuation. We're just not at that point. We need to understand the speciation of iodine at the site before we actually make some decisions. But basically, the way we look at these sites is we do a study, we do a survey, we develop a toolbox, and then we sort of start picking tools that give us a solution that we think is viable.
Okay. I think we can fit one more question in here. And Carol, this person wants to know if you have an example application of the AI ML to the project. And specifically, they want to know in what part of your project was that technology useful?
I'm going to turn it over to Tom, and he's going to talk about that right now.
All right, excellent. Well, Carol, thank you so much for your time. And JP, I'm going to turn it to you to introduce our next speaker.
Thank you, Carol. Good presentation. Our next speaker, Dr. Thomas Danielson, received his PhD in material science and engineering from Virginia Tech and has an undergraduate degree in physics and mathematics. He joined the Savannah River National Laboratory in September of 2016 and is currently in the Environmental Science and Dosimetry Group. Dr. Danielson has played a key role in the developing and executing deterministic groundwater contaminant transport model for various activities at Savannah River site, including performance assessment at the E-area low-level waste facility and deactivation and decommissioning of the 235F facility. In the spring of 2020, Dr. Danielson joined the Altemis team. In addition to site cleanup activity, Dr. Danielson is developing and applying machine learning models in the areas of meteorological forecasting and proliferation event detection. Today, his presentation is titled Use of In-Situ Real-Time Monitoring for Early Warning System at SRSF Area and the area called H Basin. Welcome, Dr. Danielson. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much for the introduction. I just want to check that you can see my slides.
We can.
Okay, excellent. So again, I appreciate the introduction and happy to have the opportunity to talk here today. Really appreciate all the background information that Carol presented in the previous talk. And in this particular talk, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit more about some of the techniques that have gotten us to the point of where we're just about ready to stick some sensors in wells and along the basin cap. So I want to give some of that background as well as what it's going to look like going forward. And then as far as the D-area coal ash basins, I'd like to talk a bit about some of the challenges, I guess. That project has just kicked off earlier in this year, and so we're just kind of getting our hands dirty with the data sets, and so I want to kind of talk about some of the things and some of the challenges that go along with working with these environmental data sets. So with that, I'll go ahead and get started. So Carol touched on sort of the complex wide view. I just wanted to quickly give an overview of the Savannah River site and talk about some of the interesting problems that we have there from some of the legacy operations. So the Savannah River site is a key DOE site responsible for environmental stewardship and cleanup, waste management, and disposition of nuclear materials. It's about a 310 square mile site right along the border of South Carolina and Georgia, just outside of Aiken and Augusta. And we have a long nuclear materials production history. So originally there were five nuclear materials production reactors on site, all of which are shut down now and in various stages of deactivation and decommissioning. There are two separations plants, a heavy water extraction plant, nuclear fuel and target fabrication facilities, as well as solid and liquid waste disposition processes. And so all of this is sort of left an environmental legacy of around 130 million liters of highly contaminated liquid. There are six fuel basins, decommissioned radiological facilities, 515 contaminated soil and groundwater sites. There are five coal-fired power plants, again, in some phase of deactivation and decommissioning or potential operation. And then all of this, again, you know, has left around an estimated 2 million cubic meters of contaminated groundwater. So the benefit to that is that we have these, you know, unique opportunities to go out and develop new technologies and new strategies for long-term monitoring and environmental cleanup. And we take that job very seriously and we enjoy doing it. So Carol touched on a lot of this, but I'll just sort of recap the history, just to give that background of Altemis. Again, the basins were in operation from about 1955 to the late 80s, early 90s. There were 7 billion liters of acidic low-level radioactive waste that were pumped into the basins. In the early 90s, the basins were dewatered and eventually capped and closed. And then over time, there were several remediation and attenuation strategies that were put into place, which Carol introduced really well in the last talk. So our goal in this project is basically to implement sensor networks and technologies so that we can monitor these enhanced attenuation strategies over the long term and identify if any shifts in either the environment in terms of climate change, rainfall, or the geochemistry might have the potential to remobilize these attenuated contaminants. So Carol highlighted the zones of vulnerability, the three zones of vulnerability. At the basin soil and the VEO zone. So again, this is a capped basin. So any degradation of that cap or subsidence that might occur along that cap can promote increased water infiltration, impacting those basin soils and ultimately transport down through the VEO zone and into the aquifer zones. We have the treatment gates in the treatment zones in the gates where, again, changes in either that potentiometric surface or the geochemistry around that area could promote that remobilization and the wetlands. And so so what I'll get into here is a few details on the technologies that we're trying to implement in these areas. Both various types of sensing technologies that essentially we will create data sets that will be transmitted throughout the group. And then we can, you know, perform modeling, apply artificial intelligence and machine learning, and again, kind of develop robust strategies going forward based on the shifts that are seen. Okay, so kind of one of the first stages, and I'll touch on this again when we get to D area in this type of work, is to you know, identify the master variables. And Carol talked about their process there, but getting a little bit more into the detail here, you can use things like principal component analysis to explore kind of your system as a whole and how things are actually interacting with one another. Carol mentioned that there are around 100 groundwater wells that are out there. So this gives us, you know, data sets that are spanning back to, say, the 1980s. In you know, various levels of different levels of being thorough, I guess. In some cases, you have gaps and things of that nature. Not all wells have the same analytes, but you can do this sort of on a well-by-well basis based on, you know, time and space to really start to understand this. So looking at this principal component analysis plot, for example, if you have vectors that are pointing in the same direction, they're nearby one another, that would indicate that you have a strong positive correlation between those analytes that you're looking at there. Things that are vectors, I guess, that are pointing in the opposite direction or at 180 degrees would be a stronger negative correlation, and vectors that might be orthogonal to one another indicate that there's very little to no correlation. So that's, again, that's kind of a technique that you can use to sort of look at your system as a whole and start to understand how things are really related. You can take a little bit more of a one-to-one type approach. So showing here a Pearson correlation plot where you're looking at specific conductance and uranium, and you can identify those correlations there and how strongly they're correlated with one another. And then ultimately, once you do this across your system and for the contaminants of interest, you can take this knowledge about the correlations that you have, and you can use techniques like the Kalman filter to actually make predictions about the concentration over time. And so Haruko has a paper that demonstrates this specifically at F area for a couple of the wells that are out there and the correlations that they identified and compared to the historical data sets that they have. And there was very good performance based on that work. Okay, so we understand the master variables. We know what we want to measure, but again, we have around 100 wells out here. And so how do we sort of optimize where we place these sensors in which wells? We have some sort of high-level ideas because we know where the basin is, for example. So we know where most of the bulk concentration is probably flowing. But yet, you know, we're also concerned with some of the upstream in terms of that potentiometric surface. And so so the idea would be that we would place some sensors around the outside to where we could, say, measure the water table elevation. And then we would also place some of these sensors that can measure some of these geochemical master variables along sort of the bulk of the plume. And so so the fundamental idea is measure many master variables in kind of the plume center of mass and measure fewer around the outside. And so there was a technique developed, again, by Haruko, Himanshu, and Aurelien Murray from FIU to basically interpolate using the historical data reference field Among basically all of the wells, or a large majority of the wells that have a good data set, and then sort of add and subtract wells within that reference field to identify which locations can best reproduce the reference field or minimize the mean square error between them. So you do this across many different analytes and across time and of course also space, and from that you can identify an optimized location for your sensors. And so using this technique, it was basically narrowed down to right around 25 wells that we'll install sensors in. And so this is kind of showing that layout. Again, we're using two classes of sensors. We're using in situ brand sensors, the Aquatrols. The Aquatrol 500 are these lighter blue circles, again, measuring many of the master variables. So things like specific conductance, pH, oxidation reduction potential, as well as water table elevation, temperature, and things of that nature. And again, we're placing those sort of along those locations where that plume center of mass is located. And then the Aquatrol 200, which measures temperature and depth, as well as specific conductance. And we place those sort of to the north side of the basins, all the way down toward the wetland locations down here, south of the funnel and gate barrier system. Okay, so like I mentioned, we're getting really close to installing these sensors in the wells. The team has made a number of trips over the past couple years to try to identify everything that needs to get into place. And so I just wanted to kind of highlight that we have the infrastructure in terms of wells, but in order to go out and actually install the sensors into the wells, we need to make some modifications to that existing infrastructure. And because we have 25 different wells that we've selected here, you know, we have a number of different cases. Fortunately, ACP at the Savannah Riverside has worked with us very closely to help us identify what we can do, what's viable, and we're working on getting these modifications put in place right now. And so you can see in some cases, it's fairly straightforward. Basically, you know, open the enclosure and we should be able to pretty much drop a sensor in once we've pulled out the pump or modified the pump if need be. In other cases, it gets a little bit more complicated. And so we have to actually make some wellhead modifications so that we can accommodate actually putting a sensor into that well. So many trips documenting what needs to be done and what those changes will look like. In addition to that, we've pretty much talked about this in sort of, two-dimensional space, looking at sort of an image of a plume from an overhead vantage point. But of course, we also have, a vertical component here. And so we have to decide where is the optimal location vertically within the well screen to place the sensor so that we're capturing data that is relevant to the plume. And so we've just completed this here within the past week or two. And how we did that was we took a probe out to each one of these wells. In fact, we only had to do it for about 18 of the 25 wells. And what we did was take measurements of the various master variables that we'll be looking at. But the variable of biggest concern is specific conductance, because it's directly proportional to the number of ions that are in the water. And so we pulled the pumps out of the wells. We allowed the water to sort of equilibrate for about a week or so. And then we took our probes out there and we dropped the probe basically in 1 foot increments, kind of letting it, very slowly, letting it equilibrate for 2, 3, 4 minutes at a time. And then took our measurement basically to identify the area or the location within that well screen that had the highest specific conductance. So again, we did this for all 18 of the wells. It turns out after doing this that in pretty much every case, it's best to install the sensor, as near to the bottom of the well screen as possible, and then have the pump placed above that sensor. Okay, and so once we take sensors out and we install them in each of these 25 wells, or it's kind of looking like we'll do this in sort of campaigns where we prioritize sensors, but essentially how this will look is we'll install them in the wells, we can transmit that data over the Verizon cellular network, and it'll go up into in situ's cloud. And from there, as Carol mentioned, this is a large team. All of the people who are involved with the data analytics will be able to pull that data down to their respective systems and perform the analytics that they want to. Okay, so that was the sensors in wells. Now I just wanted to touch on the electrical resistive tomography. So basically, this work is being done by Tim Johnson from PNNL, and we at SRNL have sort of been coordinating between Tim and ACP to be able to actually go out and install this system along the basin cap. And so essentially how this works is there's a resistivity meter and a power source, and then a multi-core cable that's placed just about 6 or so inches into the surface of the cap. And so basically you apply a current, measure the potential difference. And ultimately what you can wind up doing when you sort of ping each of these electrodes in sort of different locations, different combinations, is you can sort of create a map of the moisture content in the subsurface based on the conductivity or resistivity readings that you're getting from that. And so we did a test last August, basically so that Tim could sort of go back and do some modeling and sort of optimize based on the actual soils. Originally, he had made some assumptions about the soils and what the conductivity would look like so that he could optimize his design for this. For this, we just used a single linear array along the surface of the cap. And so Tim came up with this image. So what we're most interested in here, of course, is at the upper layers. And so you can see that we have the topsoil, and then we have the fabric, the drainage layer, basically, with the fabric and the sand drainage layer. And then we have the backfill. And so taking these measurements, that's what we want to look at. And we want to identify that most of the moisture is contained to those upper layers and not so much down here in the clay layers. And so Tim was very encouraged by the readings that we had. And from that, he was basically able to go back very quickly and optimize the layout. We'll be installing this, actually beginning the install on July 11th. So coming up quickly. And the final layout basically will look something like this. So we've got 8 rows of electrodes with 16 electrodes in each row. I should say eight rows of cables and 16 electrodes in each cable at a 5x5 meter spacing. Those will all run back over here to sort of the hub within, you know, a building right outside of the basins. And then that data, again, will be transmitted over the cellular network directly to PNNL. And then we will bring it back in and store it at SRNL, as well as on a data platform that'll be developed as part of this all. So this image in the bottom right here, this is again from Tim Johnson, and actually produced by a model, but it sort of gives you an idea of what we'll be able to, or how we'll be able to sort of visualize the subsurface along this FRA seepage basin cap once we start taking these ERT readings. Okay, so that kind of gives an idea about the sensors and some of the technologies, I guess, that'll be put in place at F area. And ultimately from that, we'll have a large data sets that are, you know, nice and complete, and we'll be able to perform modeling of all different types on it to develop really robust strategies. So now I wanted to kind of take a step back and take a look at the D area ash basins, which has just sort of kicked off within the last 6 to 8 months or so. So we've been working with the data sets, but this is really the ground floor of where it all starts and trying to understand your system and which master variables actually work well for you. So the big kind of difference here, I guess, is that rather than being concerned with radionuclide species, we're more concerned with these coal ash contaminants. So things more like heavy metals, arsenic, selenium, manganese, and various others. And so the D area ash basins are on the Savannah Riverside as well. You can see the 484D area powerhouse, which operated from the 50s up until, I believe, it was basically decommissioned in 2012. And that's when a lot of the cleanup efforts went on around here. Just right up front, the groundwater flow is basically going toward the left of this slide, toward the Savannah River, in some cases sort of to the south toward the Beaver Dam Creek. And so the ash basins, you can see, were all sort of right down here to the south and west of the 484D area powerhouse. In the cleanup efforts, the soils were excavated, they were consolidated, and ultimately they were placed in sort of one of the ends furthest away from the Savannah River, and then, of course, capped, consolidated and capped and all of that kind of stuff. So that was, again, it was completed around 2012. Also mentioned that the coal pile was sitting sort of right up in this area to the south of the powerhouse. So this is a kind of an ideal area to see if we can take some of the techniques that were developed as part of F area and apply them at a different site, because we have, 139 groundwater monitoring wells, again, with data spanning back to the mid-1980s up until present day. There are some complexities involved in the sense that some of the wells were added or removed during some of the cleanup efforts, but we have ultimately a pretty good data set with a lot of different analytes that we can take a look at and various other historical investigations that were performed as well. So I talked about the potentiometric surface already, but again, we're kind of dealing with three different aquifer confining units here. In each of these cases, the general direction of flow is toward the Savannah River over here, but, you know, of course, drawing a line perpendicular to these contours down here sort of to the southern parts, you can see that it might be flowing down into that D-area discharge canal as well. These colored lines here are basically indicating that we have some cross-sectional data. So we have some information about the hydrostatigraphy out here in D area. So that's a little bit beneficial to us. So taking a look at one of those cross sections, you can see it's mostly a mixture of sandy and clay soils. So to the right of the screen over here, that's sort of up toward the powerhouse, and then moving toward the left-hand side of the screen, that's more down toward the wetland areas. And you can see there's just some changes in that hydrostatigraphy, but still mostly sandy clay soils. So getting into some of the complexity. So this is an example of a beryllium plume emanating from the coal pile up here. And what you can see, something I wanted to sort of point out, is that if you look at some of the wells that are in, you know, fairly close proximity, both sitting over one of the ash landfills, that plume is really captured by one of them and then not by another. And so you may think you're looking at the data sort of in a nearby location, you should see, you know, very similar results, but that's just simply not always the case. This is illustrating this again. We can't forget about that Z direction of this problem. And so this is showing the beryllium plume in the subsurface. So you notice at DCB 23 here, we've got four different well screens. And you notice that the screens B and C are both within the plume, kind of the bulk of that concentration. But then A and D are giving, you know, would probably give significantly different readings because they're outside of sort of the bulk of that plume. So when we start to look at these correlations and we're looking at this on sort of a well-by-well basis, or we're looking across time, we can have gaps in our data. We can have, you know, drastically different behavior in terms of what we might think we might see looking at two nearby wells. And that's sort of illustrated again here by looking at the correlations with some of the contaminants that we've been looking at. And so you'll notice that pretty much for everything except for manganese here, when we look at these correlations, we have sort of a mixed bag of what we see. We have some strong positive correlations. We have some strong negative correlations, sometimes all in the same picture. Manganese is pretty much, you know, strong positive correlations all across the board with specific conductance in this particular case. And so just sort of illustrating this a little bit further, looking at two wells that are sort of within 500 feet of each other, well screens at roughly the same elevation, have the same matrix material. And if we look at the different analytes at those two wells, so sort of up top here, maybe a little tough to read, we have the contaminants of interest. And then on the bottom, we've got the master variables that we're looking at. You can see that in most cases, the plots are not all that well correlated with one another. In some cases, we do see some correlation, but not always. And so we really have to understand exactly where the contaminants are. We have to have a strong conceptual model in order to actually make sense using, you know, the exploratory data analytics of what's going on. And we have to be very careful, and it can be a very time-consuming process as we work through that. I also wanted to just highlight quickly that in some cases you've got, you know, upwards of 10 feet fluctuations in the water table at these wells. And so when we were looking at the image of the cross section with the screens, if you have a 2.5 foot well screen, then a 10-foot fluctuation in the water table could have, you know, some implications in terms of how those measurements sort of fluctuate over time. So ultimately, these data sets can be really messy, and again, it just takes some time and effort to really get to the bottom of things. So kind of concluding, I've said it a couple times now, these can be complicated to work with, but it really provides an opportunity to create easy to comprehend geochemical conceptual models. And ultimately, it can lead toward the installation of sensor networks around the zones of vulnerability that have been identified, and ultimately enhance environmental data sets as it is. So the sensor networks in F area will give us sort of continuous readings. Assuming that the sensors work well, we'll have good data. We don't lose our calibration or anything like that. We'll have really, really nice data sets to be able to work with, and ultimately improve the robustness of models, both artificial intelligence and more deterministic models. And so the end result of all this can be a more proactive and cost-effective approach to long-term monitoring and cleanup activities. So I'd like to acknowledge, of course, the Altimus team, as well as the team who's been working on D-Area and our funding sources. And with that, happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you. We did have a quick question on the number of sensors you used in each well.
Yeah, so so there have been some studies during Altimus. What we'll be installing is just a single sensor in each of these wells, but there has been some effort put in place to do some sort of depth discrete measurements as well with the sensors. But for the final installation, it will just be single sensors.
Okay. And then we did have an attendee who noted that monitoring wells are mixed environments that may affect the master variable measurements like pH and ORP. Have you used soil sensors instead of the in-well sensors?
So we will be installing soil temperature sensors. We don't have any other soil sensors that we're looking at this point in time.
Okay. Well, I think we have reached, unfortunately, the end of your segment here. I'm going to turn it back over to JP to introduce our next speaker.
Thank you, Tom. Our next speaker, Dr. Himanshu Upadhyay, has served the Florida International University Applied Research Center principal scientist for the past 21 years, overseeing the Artificial Intelligence Cybersecurity Enterprise System Research Group. He also an adjunct professor in the College of Electrical and Computer Engineering. He brings more than 30 years experience in artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, cybersecurity, information technology, management, and engineering to this role, serving as a co-principal investigator for multi-million dollar cybersecurity and artificial intelligence project for the Department of Defense and Defense Intelligence Agency. He is also responsible for knowledge waste management, artificial intelligence, and big data research project for the Department of Energy Office of Environmental Management. He has published multiple papers in the area of cybersecurity, machine learning, big data, knowledge, nuclear waste management, and service-oriented architecture. His current research focuses on artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, big data, cyber analytic visualization, cyber forensic, malware analysis, and blockchain. Today, his presentation is titled Artificial Intelligence and Machine Learning Technique for Long-Term Monitoring of Soil and Groundwater Contamination. Welcome. The floor is yours, Himanshu.
Thank you. Everyone can hear me?
We can.
Thank you. So thanks, JP, and thanks, Carol and Tom for excellent presentation. And so I will be taking that reference while I'm going through the presentation. And my presentation is divided into two parts. One, I'm going to talk about advanced automated machine learning system that we have developed under Department of Defense Test Resource Management Center funding. And then it is being transitioned to DOEEM, Office of Environmental Management, in the next few months. And then I will connect like how this system can be used. And the example I'll take is the one that Carol and Tom talked about. And a lot of the business has been already, the requirements have already been discussed. The problem sets have been discussed. I'll be just connecting those dots along with this particular system. So this is actually the research that we have been working
on. Manchu, just very quickly, we're not seeing your screen yet. You need to share your slides with us.
Is it, you can
okay.
see?
Okay, I can see. And if you go into slideshow mode, I'll confirm that they're working.
All right, so it's in the slideshow.
Yes, everything looks great. Thank you.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. So this system was developed under funding from Test Resource Management Center from Department of Defense. And so I'll be talking about this solution, and then we are transitioning this solution to DOEEM and supporting multiple national labs. So we have designed here based on our experience working with the technology since 2016. We have divided, we have come up with a framework actually. You can see here it is divided into three parts. On the left is the application domain. So what just Carol talked about and Tom talked about is actually we refer to as application area or the domain. And you can have data from multiple domains. So this particular system can be applied to many different areas. We have developed this for solving cyber problems, but I'll show you like how this can be used for soil and groundwater, nuclear decommissioning, and many other areas of blockchain, for example. The same framework, the same technology, but it is versatile and can be applied to many different fields. What you see in the middle is actually the AI ML technologies, and it's all the name of different frameworks and the algorithms actually that are available in this framework. We have done research on multiple frameworks and multiple algorithms, and then we have come up with a set of algorithms that are really applicable on the time series data or sequential sensor data, as well as imagery data. And so they are all packaged in the middle tier, which is basically the technology. And then how do you operationalize? So once you take the data from application area, combine that data with all the AI ML technologies to build your machine learning model, how do you use that model to deploy and use it in the field? And that's where the operationalization of the AI ML comes into picture. That's basically providing the IT infrastructure and the applications that you develop around that to solve the problem. So I will just match this with the example that was discussed in the previous presentation. So we are collecting sensor data from Samana River site. And so that data is related to master variable, proxy variables and master variables associated with different contaminants. And so once you collect that data and then you use different machine learning or deep learning technologies to build your model. And once you do that, then you operationalize that model. And that's where you saw that in situ cloud deployment was there, where actually we can consume that data exposed as a REST API. And then you can build the data, build the model with the historical data, and then they can be fine-tuned as we go through the process here. So it is constantly refined, and it will perform prediction actually based on the current data that is being recorded from these in-situ sensors that are being deployed in the wells. So this is actually the mapping of one solution at Savannah River site and how this framework or the architecture can be mapped to that. And it has three different components here. This gives you a high-level architecture. You can have data sources from any application area, and they can be stored in network file share. So basically in any of the file systems, or it will be stored in the database, or it can be stored in the big data cluster. So these are normally three of the major storage repositories that you will see in the field where the data is actually stored. On the right side top, you see actually all the analytics system with machine learning, deep learning, different servers that are deployed that can read the data in real time and perform in-memory analytics and build a model and do prediction. So those are the two top blocks that go hand in hand in order for us to kind of read the data, build the model and do the prediction. The bottom one actually is the analytics control center that allows the user actually to interact with the data or interact with the algorithms and the frameworks and the model that is in the blue side actually. So it provides kind of a web-based interface that the user from their browser should be able to manage the system. So this is a little drill down actually of the same architecture. As you can see here, right on the bottom, you have a client workstation on the browser that you are trying to access the entire system using your browser actually interface. And on the top is actually shows you all the features, which is exploration, visualization, model building, prediction, and the management here. And I will show you interface, how it looks actually, and there are repetitive, these are the repetitive work that only changes with the change in the data. And that's what is shown on the right side. And how do we connect that? That's where basically the AI ML server, that gray interface that comes into picture here. On the left side, you see here AI ML processing engine, and every job or every application has a different requirement. So that's the reason we have a standalone system here or a distributed system. So now the distributed system can take advantage of parallel processing using multiple servers, or it will use something called GPU servers that can do a large amount of image processing or the big data cluster. So we can have any kind of combinations that we have deployed here at FIU, depending upon the requirement any of that architecture can be used to process the data. And if the data set is small and moreover, it can be solved with the standalone machine learning server. So in that case, we do not have to go to the distributed processing engine. Towards the middle, you see the data storage. Now we are separating the layers actually so that the storage can be separate from the processing. And as I mentioned previously, it can have network storage, database storage, and the big data storage. And at the top, even though the system was built for cyber, but we have used that for IoT. Even in our university, we have robotics team, and you saw the presentation on 6th actually, and we are working with them also for robotics application. Similarly, energy, environment, and water. So you name the domain. The system is very versatile and it can support any of these application areas and domain. So this is the high level architecture of the system that I'm going to present next. So this shows you a homepage of the advanced automated machine learning system here. And it's a web interface, kind of a website actually that you can access from any location here. This shows you actually a typical data science workflow that is used when you are trying to apply machine learning to solve any specific problem. It starts from data acquisition, and Tom and Carol, they talked about like we are at a stage where we are installing server, and then we are going to extract that data, measuring different characteristics of water, which we call proxy variables, which relate to the contaminants, which was that correlation that was discussed in the previous presentation. So data acquisition becomes the first part. And once you have the data, how do you explore? So data exploration is a very repetitive process, actually. So we are putting a bunch of algorithm here, as well as the statistical analysis that can help in understanding the exploration. Once you explore that, you look at visualization, how the data looks like. You can generate multiple charts and all. Then you have pre-processing. Pre-processing basically means you have the raw data that's coming from the field. How do you format that data in a way that the machine learning algorithms can understand? So one of the key part is all data has to be numeric. If you are collecting some data that is text data, then in that case, definitely you have to have some kind of encoding mechanism in the background that will help you in converting that data to some kind of numeric form, and which will represent the information that is there in the string or the object form actually. Then we talk about feature engineering. Features are nothing but attributes of your data. And so you need to define or use which attributes are important. So that's where the domain expertise or subject matter expert comes into picture. But there are different workflows. You can have an automated way where the system itself will decide which features are important based on the algorithms that we have put in place. Or else the user should be able to identify these are the features which we think are important and should be used for the model building. And then the 6, 7, 8, and 9, basically all are the machine learning, optimization, model building, training steps that normally goes with any kind of model development. And once you develop the model, then you have to operationalize the model. And that's where that IT infrastructure, the third pillar I was talking about, that these systems get models get deployed through that IT infrastructure, and the users can use those systems to do the prediction and view the prediction results. Currently, we have classification, regression, time series, and anomaly detection types of algorithms. And that means those kind of problems can be solved using this system. When we say classification, it is more focused on categorization, whether the coming stream of data belongs to a category one or a category two. The example is like if email system is coming, it's a good email or a spam, the decision is made real time. And those are actually classification kinds of problem. The one that was discussed by Tom and Carol regarding the master variable and the contaminants, those are regression problems. And once we attach time to that, it becomes time series problem. The other one is anomaly detection. So if you have a range in which your contaminants should be, if it goes beyond that range, then we want the alert to be sent. So currently the process is more manual. Everyone is monitoring that, plotting the graph, and then making a determination whether a particular contaminant like iodine or uranium, tritium has gone beyond the range. So defined by the federal agency. So then now we can deploy a machine learning model that can monitor. And if something goes beyond the range that was predicted, then automatically the alerts can be sent. So those alerts and all, they become the part of the IT system that will have to be developed based on the models and the prediction that we have done here. Now, what you saw, that was a traditional workflow. But what we have done in our automated system, you have definitely the data source from where we are trying to connect and get the data. The whole effort is not to duplicate the data. So what it means is wherever the data is, if we have the ability to connect, we can do in-memory analytics by loading all the data in memory in real time. If it is not, then definitely we need to move the data in real time to do the model building and prediction. Then you have data exploration, data visualization. So all the activities of model building, they are all combined together. So you can see there are 7 steps actually of model building and deployment. They all are combined into one step when you see the automated system. And then you use that model to do the prediction and see the results. And then there are management models. So once you build your model, you have done your prediction, 6 months down the line, you want to come and see what I have done. You can always go back and see your results as well. So that's where you do the management of the model and prediction here. So this is actually all the menus that are involved, starting with data source, exploration, visualization, model building, prediction. And this is actually the home page, and you can see there are 3 data. It starts from data source where the data is actually. So you have a way of categorizing your data so that you can manage different projects that you're trying to handle. So you can define your custom tags to manage those things. The data source can be network, means file, actually in file system or in the database or in the big data cluster. And then you are doing a training or testing. And then you have some metadata, like what is the data source name, IP address. So once you have a connectivity of the data established, this is a one-time job to connect to the data. Then the next step is you can always go and look at the data exploration here. So I'm showing you 3 different screens for connecting to the file share or connecting to the database or connecting to the big data cluster. Once you have connected to the data source, the next step is exploration. And you can see here that feature name is nothing but all the attributes that you have here. I'm showing you a cybersecurity data here as an example, where you are looking at the network traffic, but those attributes or features are not important. What is important is on the right side, like it is showing what kind of data it is. Is it an integer or a number or a text? How many observations are there? What is the minimum value in each one of the attributes or features? What's the maximum value? And then quartiles you have there. What is mean standard deviation? So if you are familiar a little bit of with the statistics, just one click of a button, entire data gets loaded into the memory and entire statistical analysis is performed based on the data that is sitting in your environment here. So this exploration helps you in understanding the distribution of the data from the statistical point of view. The next one is the data visualization. So you explored that data. Now you want to look at the distribution in the form of chart. So you can see here for each of the attributes, it's one row for each attribute or features, as you call in machine learning. And then you are doing a distribution plot, a histogram, box plot, pair plot. And I'm showing you here 4, but it will be feature-based or attributes-based. So we will read the content of your data, that is from the different data source, and then it will show you like, okay, how the data looks like actually. And from there, then you are able to select a specific feature or an attribute or all the features and attribute, like the entire data set. And then you can generate these kind of graphs just by a click of a button. So in the background, what is happening is actually once you click a button, I want to see the visualization of my, let's say, the sensor data that is coming from a particular well. The entire request is sent to the processing engine, which basically connects to the storage that I showed you previously, loads the data in memory, does all the analysis, and then displays you a very simple visual to understand how your data looks. So that's how the data visualization works. Once you are comfortable with your exploration and visualization, the next step is actually model building. Of course, this is showing you another view of the visual, where instead of looking at a particular feature, now you are looking at all the features. So Tom talked about the correlation. So this is one of the correlation plot actually. And all the scripts are implemented here is basically that came from Haruko Aurelien and the research we did with the Ultimus project. But it gives you the idea. And the pair plot is giving you correlation of all the features with respect to other features here in the form of a matrix here. So once the visualization is over, I'm giving an example of a classification machine learning model, means you are trying to categorize your observation into a particular restricted number of groups or categories here. So again, you have data source, you give a small description of the name of the model, and then you see the list of algorithms here. So these are actually the algorithms that we have expanded and automated coming from different frameworks. And so these algorithms will be used with your data in order to build your model. So you can connect the data source. You can look at the location where it is, what features are you going to use. So you have the ability to select certain features or all the features in order for you to build the model. And what is you're trying to predict actually? So all those things, I'm not going into the details like what needs to be done, but you can see this is 3 or 4 or 5 steps. That's it. So you don't have to be expert in machine learning or understanding of algorithm or writing of the Python programming and all that. It's all done for you, just sitting in the background. Once you select your attributes, you select your algorithm, and you just say build model. Now the request has gone back to the processing engine actually. And based on the type of data, it will go either to the CPU servers or GPU servers for processing. And it may take some amount of time depending upon how much data you're trying to process and what kind of algorithms you're trying to use it. And once it is done, then it will come back here and it will show you that what is the validation result here. Means what? We take whatever data you have given, 80% of the data will be used for training. And 20% will be used for testing how your model is doing. And that will be displayed here. And once you are comfortable, then you go to the prediction level. And if you think like, no, this is not something that you were looking for, the metrics that you were looking for, whether it's accuracy or any other metrics, then if you're not comfortable, you go ahead and you change your features, change your algorithms that you want to do, and then you continue the process. So it's, and this is showing you the validation result here. You can download the validation result. You can display the validation result. All the algorithms that you selected, it's all showing you here. What kind of metrics? These are all statistical metrics that are used here. And it is showing you all kinds of charts that comes out of the metrics that was displayed in the screen. So one shot, once the model is built, you're going to get this kind of result, which is the validation result for your model. So once you are comfortable with the model, and it's an iterative process, but still, as I showed you previously, that all the 5-6 steps are all bundled into one. You have to just click a button and you go from there. Now, once you do the prediction, you can see the model is already built with these algorithms. So it is automatically going to show you that you have the models for all these algorithms, combining your data and the algorithm here. And now when the new set of data, which will be your test data now, so now we are not talking about the training data. We are talking about the test data. You will have a test data source that you are connecting. And then with that, you will be able to select the model that was already built and it is stored in the AML platform and it will allow you to do the prediction. Once you do the prediction, you are going to see the results actually, which you can download the result in the CSV file or you can view the result online. So you'll see the interface is more or less as I showed you in the validation. And again, the same algorithms, and it is showing you that how this algorithm has performed. You can see that k-nearest neighbor, decision tree, neural network, and random forest, they have done a pretty good job here. But logistic regression did not do well. So that means the pattern that exists in your underlying data, logistic regression is not the kind of good algorithm that is going to work well with your data set. And then you have to ignore those things. So here we do not care about what is the reason that your data set is like this. What we are trying to understand is what's the pattern in the data. There may be time, special relationship, temporal relationship, physiological, chemical, lot of reasons why the data is like that, but we don't know the reasoning behind it because that's the science that will come from there. What the machine learning or the AI model is going to tell you is the pattern that exists in the data. Now you can go and relate like why this is happening, and then you can analyze and explain those things. But from the machine learning point of view, it is only going to tell you what the pattern, what's the pattern, the mathematical representation of the data that this model is going to build, seeing the data set exists and the algorithm that we are going to use here. So the next one is actually, once you have built this model, you have done the prediction, then it is all stored here in for the management part where you can always go and see the result. And that's what the model management and the prediction management that comes into picture here that allows you to look at the historical results in these modules. And similarly, you have the prediction results, as I showed you previously. It was real time, in line actually, but now you can always go and view them and compare that over a period of time. As I mentioned, like there is something called transfer learning. So once you build the model is as good as the pattern in the data. If it is changing, then you have to fine tune your model. And that's where we use transfer learning to do that. And that's the intent of that in situ sensor data that we are going to collect from Savannah River site. We are going to build the model using the proxy variable and the lab data that we are going to get from the sites. And that will be using a combination of multiple features, looking at different contaminants. And as we get more and more data over a period of time, starting in fall semester, let's say, we will be fine tuning our model and these models will be deployed that will be doing the prediction in real time. So that's the idea. And of course, the administration and all are there to just manage and help is there. So I'll just skip those things. Just to recap, as you saw that data science workflow is a large process here, but in advanced automated machine learning, it's just a 7-step process, starting from the data source to exploration, visualization, model building, prediction, and then visualizing your results actually. So in nutshell, this system is developed, as I mentioned, for the cyber, but it is a versatile system, can be applied to many different things. And we are going to have automated flow, which means it's targeted for the researchers, scientists, who have little to no knowledge of the system, of the machine learning, but they understand data very well. So they can just upload the data or they can connect to their data. And auto workflow will give you the process where you can just do all the 7-step. We are also planning to implement the optimization if the scientists or researchers are comfortable in understanding the parameters of the machine learning. So they should be able to actually define their parameters and the models will be built according to that. Then there will be a third actually workflow, which will be custom workflow. And like Tom talked about different well optimization techniques, like where we should be putting those sensors. So there are jobs that are not actually straight away related to machine learning, but more of a statistical part of it or the optimization part of it. So all those things will go into the custom workflow here. So this is just a summary. Actually, you can do machine learning in few steps and with a minimal machine learning knowledge here. And you can dynamically connect to the different data sources. You can explore and visualize and, of course, access the historical models. This system is available at FIU, and we will be providing support to the different national labs here. And we also have the ability to bundle all this into a single platform that can be transitioned to the national labs, but it will need support from their IT to deploy this kind of GPU servers or distributed processing servers in their environment. So this slide actually shows that FIU is supporting DOE EM problem sets in the area of D&D, soil and groundwater, with Savannah River site and Pacific Northwest National Lab. So SRNL work has been extensively covered in the previous presentation. So I will just talk about D&D, where basically we were looking at nuclear infrastructure to identify cracks actually. So this is more of image processing area of machine learning. And we have done extensive experience here, have done extensive work here, coming up with different machine learning algorithms and models like auto encoder, convolutional neural network, object detection. So you can see I have just put one slide where we have designed the network at the top, but this whole architecture is for image processing. And here we are trying to identify cracks, as you can see on the right side. And at the bottom, actually how the model has gone through over a period of 2 years to come up with a crack detection technique here and all the algorithms associated with it. But it is not specific to this because it's a generic system. So what we are planning to do here is the ERD system, which Tom was talking about. It is also generating images actually. So we have the ability to run similar kind of algorithm there and look at the baseline operation of the these ERT system, and any anomaly or deviation that is noticed in these images, humanly it may be difficult to identify, but with the pixels that we are trying to monitor using this image processing, we should be able to do that. So this is one project that can be applied to any different kind of imagery data, or in machine learning terms, it is a computer vision data that we can analyze using classification, anomaly detection, and CNN is another algorithm, group of algorithms. Actually, we call it convolutional neural network. Those are can be designed, custom built to address those problems here. And the next task is actually we are looking at a concentration of chromium with PNNL. And here also, again, we are looking at contaminants in different operable units. We are looking at different wells here, but this is very focused to the chromium concentration. And you will see that similar set of algorithms finally tuned to address the chromium problem in the Pacific Northwest National Lab is being addressed through this task, actually. And of course, the last task is one which we are supporting Altimus project here, where I'm working with Carol and Tom and Haruko from Lawrence Berkeley, where we are looking at well optimization, mapping of proxy and master variable, developing deep learning models, actually, that can predict in real time the contaminants, and we'll be using transfer learning to kind of fine-tune our models so that it can send alerts on a regular basis. So that's planned with those 26 wells at this time with multiple sensors recording different information about the analytes. So that's what I wanted to share with the team here. And I wanted to have a demo, but it looks like that's difficult in the interest of time. And I'll be happy to answer if any questions.
All right, thank you. We do have some time for a few questions here before we move on to break. And so let me start with this first question. Did you use your model to fingerprint the sources of commingled plumes?
Okay, so I don't know, Tom is here. Probably he can answer, but we are looking at I'm not sure, like, from the plumes, which plumes the data is coming, but we know that these wells are, wherever the wells are installed, we are looking at those wells and then building the model specifically collected by the sensor data that is that we are getting from the sites through the in situ cloud, actually.
Okay. Can you talk a bit about the type of QA, QC work that might take place with all of the steps of your data processing and modeling?
So as I discussed, like, there will be an auto process where actually once you select the data, the entire system runs here. The QA can be done at every step. So let's say you are doing a pre-process. There is one module that's coming, which you did not see here, is a pre-processing. If you bring the data and the data is mix of numbers and text, naturally, first step is to pre-process so that you encode the your text data. Once you have that, then you do the statistical analysis. So we will be presenting all the ranges of the data analysis of that. Plus, we will be listing all the outliers that you have here automatically. Now, then after, it's up to the user to decide, like, whether they consider that as an outlier or the anomaly of the system. And then that will have to be determined at that stage. And then the third is, actually, when we do the model building and the validation is actually depending upon the data and the quality of your data. If you are not getting your results, that means the quality of data from all the features that exist may not be that great. And in that case, you have to start filtering that in the normal, in the auto process here, selecting few features. When you come to the optimization process, you get the ability to do those changes, and then you see the impact, and that is how you can look into the QA/QC process of the entire workflow.
Okay, we did have a question that came in about confidence levels, and they were wondering if you could answer what confidence level and uncertainties are considered acceptable to establish an appropriate model and then ultimately get to acceptable conclusions when you're working with AI data.
So yeah, that's a very challenging problem, actually. And it all depends upon the objective of your problem. So when we talk about the metrics, they are actually used in evaluating your data, your model. So in certain circumstances, let's say the 95% accuracy or the metrics is fine. And in certain circumstances, if you are looking at health data, it is 99% or 99.9%, depending upon the metrics. So that's why we always say that it's all probabilistic here. And it, human in the loop is extremely important in order for you to make that determination. determination whether what is a metric that is acceptable to you based on the problem that you are trying to define. And it will change from problem to problem. So that will decide whether particular results are acceptable or not acceptable. And the validation of those results, actually. So you will look at the repeatability. So there are certain parameters in the hyperparameter optimization terms that you can define that will make the model deterministic. And it will also calculate like, okay, what is kind of the risk involved there in doing those kind of calculation. And those statistical analysis can be, and the results can be shared as well.
Okay. We had a question about the crack detection. Uh-huh. They asked, can you step through differentiation and what is machine learning?
So the question is, what is machine learning? Or the mm-hmm. question is, how did we go through the crack detection?
Well, it just says from the crack detection, can you step through differentiation and what is machine learning?
Okay. So let me just define, actually, these terms are used and interchangeably. What is AI, what's machine learning, and what's deep learning? So artificial intelligence is the field, actually, where we are trying to make computers are smarter like humans, actually. They can think, act, and adapt. So that's the whole interest here. And then there are a bunch of algorithms which can be combined with the data to achieve that goal. And it is very difficult and challenging, but all that effort is being done in that direction. So AI is the bigger umbrella in that you can have search algorithm, optimization algorithms, machine learning, deep learning algorithms, natural language processing algorithms. Now, once you come to machine learning, we do not program anything here. What we do here, we take algorithms based on the problem or the areas that you're trying to address, and then we combine that with the data. Now, it's the job of the algorithm to look at the data and come up with the model. And when we say model, what it means actually, it's actually a mathematical, complex mathematical representation of the underlying data. So let's say if you have only two parameters or one feature, X, for example, and you are generating something Y, which is on Y axis. So Y is equal to F of X, where function F is the one that we are trying to learn from these algorithms. So that's machine learning. So when we say that we are trying to learn from the pattern or that exists in the underlying data, basically we are trying to find out that mathematical model. So when we give new input, the model has not seen, then it should generate the output. And then what is deep learning, which I will be using here in this example, which is a special class of machine learning that is only focused on one kind of algorithm called neural networks, actually. And then now it has been so successful in last 2 to 3 years, neural network has given tremendous result. It takes a lot of processing power, but it gives you very good result. And that's why that field is in the research is expanding, and it has been commercialized also. So what do you see here on the top is actually convolutional neural network. So just think of this as orange and the yellow section. Do not think of the right section. So that's actually different layers of convolutional neural network here. So the images are passed through these layers, and algorithm is learning through the values of different pixels that image consists of. And then it tries to store that and generate certain weights and activation functions. So these are actually all the terminologies that is used in deep learning. So once the model is built, so basically what it means is we have learned all those attributes of the model, basically the parameters of the model that will allow to build our mathematical equation. So when the new image you transfer, it is going to identify if there are changes or not compared to what we have in the baseline. So here, what we are doing here in this particular case, let's say I have built a model with all my clean images, like there are no cracks at all. And that model is measuring error, that there is very low error using autoencoder. And this is encoding on the left side and decoding on the right side. So once this model is built, now I feed an image where we have a crack. So naturally, when we try to do this analysis, the error is going to be very, very high because it is not seeing the baseline, but it is looking at the crack here, which you see here. And then, of course, we are generating a heat map. That crack is detected here. But the technology behind the scene we are using is kind of object detection. And what you see here at the bottom, actually, we are giving ground truth, basically, like there are no cracks here. And then no green section is showing you object detection of this crack when there is no optimization done. And then, of course, blue and the yellow section is the one where you see that the model is trained to detect these kind of objects. So similarly, if you have a, so now our object in this particular case is a crack, actually. But if you are driving on the road, you want to identify if you have an image here that has bus, trucks, and all that. So once the model is trained to identify that this particular object is a truck, this particular object is a car, then once it is trained, it is going to identify those objects in the future. So that is the concept we are using here to kind of do this processing and identify the cracks which the model has seen. But we are not showing that, we are showing different kind of cracks here. That can be one approach. What we did is anomaly detection. If the surface is clean, there is nothing, that's my base model. Now, if there is any crack, then I'm going to detect that. That's the idea we are thinking in the ERT image that Tom talked about, that we have a baseline operation of Samana River site, whatever it is. Now, if there is a deviation, that model should be able to predict from the baseline, and that will be the anomalous behavior. So we can use the same algorithms and tweak in different ways, use different optimization parameters to address those needs, actually. Of course, it was a long answer, but I think I tried to cover as much as possible.
No, actually, I think you did a great job. And I know we are actually running a bit short on time here. So I think, JP, if it's okay, let's go ahead and move on with our next speaker, who will be David Williams. And then we may come back and share some agency announcements later on when we do some of our wrap up and discussion. Sure. So thank you so much for that presentation. I'm going to call up the presentation materials for David. And JP, whenever you're ready, I'm going to swap the view over to you. And then David, as long as you're with us on the phone, you can unmute whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Jean, and thank you, Himanshu. So our next speaker is David Williams. David Williams is a research scientist with EPA ORD Center for Environmental Measurement and Modeling. He has been working on characterizing and mapping contaminants at Superfund site and other areas of concern for over 25 years using ground-based, airborne, and satellite imaging systems. Today, his presentation titled Application of Imaging Spectroscopy and Machine Learning to Chemometrics. Welcome, Mr. Williams. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Do I have to do star six?
No, you're fine. David, you were off of mute. So David, go ahead and hit star six again. You're good.
Okay, thank you. All right, my apologies. I'm using my phone and a desk phone to do this presentation today. So first slide up. This is the application of imaging spectroscopy and machine learning to chemometrics. And the slide, the picture that you're seeing right there is an image from an imaging spectrometer that NASA flies, and that is Moffett Field in San Francisco. And I'll discuss why this looks the way it does, but basically it's an image that's composed of hundreds of spectral bands. And by analyzing these spectral bands, we can do mineral mapping and material characterization. And then I'll discuss how to use statistical methods to do some more chemistry. Next slide, please. So the topics I'm going to talk about today is, what is imaging spectroscopy? There's some people in the audience that know what it is, and maybe some folks that do not know what it is. It's a technology that's been around for several decades, and it's currently being used in a wide variety of applications, not just Earth remote sensing, but these cameras are put on conveyor belts, and they look at fruit and meat and other targets or materials to do things like sorting and looking for diseases and other other interesting things. It's also, people use it for actually body scanning and looking for cancers in your skin. So it has a large variety of applications. I'm going to talk about, after that, what I mean by chemometric methods and how we use that to map soil contaminants, especially in areas that are large in scale and where field-based methods are not as usable because of just the cost and the wear and tear on people to go out and map using traditional methods like field sampling. Then I'll talk about the new constellations of Earth observing satellite systems that have hyperspectral capabilities. So there's a couple on orbit now, and within the next couple of years, the commercial industry promises to have hundreds of satellites on orbit that do similar things to what I'll show you that we do from aircraft systems. And then discuss briefly how to access this data when it comes online. Next slide, please. So imaging spectroscopy is also called hyperspectral imaging. And what that means is it's a spectrometer-based system where we have hundreds and hundreds of continuous spectral bands. So instead of having five or six bands in one part of the spectrum and then maybe some more elsewhere, that's called a multispectral system. And they have a lot of utility, and they've been used for many, many years. A hyperspectral imager has all the bands continuous, that is, they're within a certain spectral space of each other, maybe 5 to 10 nanometers, continuously across the spectral range. So the data that we collect is identical to what you would have in the laboratory, except for the fact that it's an image and not just a single plot of data. So these are two slides that are commonly used to convey this concept. And on the left, we have one that was developed by European Space Agency, and it shows what we're talking about, where we have light that's from the sun, it goes to the ground, and then is collected through a telescope, put through a spectrometer, and put on a detector array, and that creates the signatures of the materials that we're interested in. By combining that, we actually can create a calibrated image cube. And on the next other picture is one that was developed by JPL, which kind of shows the stacking of the spectral images that when you combine them can be used to understand the material that you're looking for. So vegetation has a very unique spectral signature, water, soil, and the atmosphere all have different spectral responses. And by analyzing that data, we can do material mapping. Next slide, please. So these are what these instruments look like. These are instruments that I have on EPA's remote sensing platform, which is called TEROS, which is, I'm not going to go in the acronym, but it's a small system, and these cameras are very small, but they can collect hundreds and hundreds of spectral channels. And the one system is in the visible, and the other system is in the shortwave infrared, and when you combine those, you have a very good characterization of the spectral response materials across the visible, which the human eye can see, and out to the shortwave infrared, which the human eye cannot see, but also has a lot of information. There's a lot of minerals that have spectral features in the shortwave infrared, and we leverage that to do material mapping. Next slide, please. So again, these instruments are smaller and getting smaller. Our instrument now can be put into a pod that's flown on an aircraft. And we could also fly it on several other types of NASA aircraft. NASA is working together with EPA to develop this technology. And for people in the audience that are familiar with this technology, there's also miniaturized systems that could go on UAVs. So they're almost to the point now where you can have them almost ubiquitous with the UAV type fleet, or soon they're going to be on orbit in very small satellites called CubeSats, which allows us to cover the Earth's surface with these imaging systems using just hundreds and hundreds of small satellites on orbit. So this is what the images look like. So on the one side, on the left, you have this squirrely looking image. That's because as the aircraft is flying, it's getting buffeted by the winds and the atmosphere. So it's kind of moving around in space, and it's hard to really understand that image. But then we can model that movement and reprocess the image to make an actual human interpretable image. And this is, I believe, an area in Tennessee. So you see a lot of, it's a mining activity. So you see some mining features where they've been doing extraction. And this is the image that we use, that we work with for mapping. So getting up a little bit closer, we're looking at the visible to near infrared spectrometer. So this is a picture, but it's actually, like I said, composed of hundreds of spectral channels. So in this image, we have acid mine drainage in yellow. So there's a pool that's highlighted in red box. There's a pool of the oxyhydroxysulfate mineral, and it's very low pH, high iron, but also has a lot of trace compounds, arsenic, in its crystal structure. So we can understand that by looking at the spectral response. But we can also map that across the landscape by comparing that AMD spectra to other materials in the image. And we can quickly determine where these features are in the image by looking at the difference between AMD and trees, roads, and water, and other features in the image. It's just a quick way to map these materials. So where chemometrics comes in is we're using image spectroscopy or hyperspectral image systems to map materials such as minerals, vegetation, and water. These systems are very good for that. We have decades and decades of theory as to why a mineral has a certain spectral response in certain wavelengths. So, well, that's very helpful when we're mapping actual minerals. But when we want to understand the amount of trace metals or heavy metals in soils or on iron oxides or other minerals, we need to go deeper than our current analysis method. So to do that, we start to employ machine learning, where we're taking large amounts of data, applying training sets to that data, and then using statistical methods, which I'll describe in a moment, to mine that data set to look for relationships in the data that will be used to predict the amount of heavy metal or trace compound in our material of interest. So, example, you know, metals and metalloids such as arsenic, they can occur on the landscape in different ways. They could be absorbed to iron oxides. They could be bound to clays. They could be incorporated into organic matter, depending on the chemical reactions that formed it and that's going on in the environment that you're looking at. So chemometrics is a statistical method that is using machine learning type methods where we have a universe, so to speak, of samples, but we use a subset of that those samples as a training set where we have known soil metal concentrations and spectral data for the same point on the landscape. And then we use that relationship developed through these methods to then go through the entire image and do predictions of contaminant amounts or concentrations in other areas in the image. So standard machine learning methods use training data. This system uses the same idea, but then we use specialized class statistics to analyze the data. Next slide, please. So we're using partial least squares regression, and it's a similar to principal components for people in the audience that are familiar with that, where in our case, the matrix that we're building, we have our X component, which is hundreds of bands of spectral information, and the Y matrix, or the Y component of the matrix, is our metal analysis. It could be from X-ray fluorescence. Typically, we do that in the field. Or it could be from any kind of analytical method, ICP, or other system. What we're doing is we need metal concentrations that are related, that we now relate to the spectral information. They're two different systems, but using the statistical technique, we create associations between the two. So again, the PSLR is very similar to principal components, but we're using more variables in this technique. So real quick discussion of what a PSLR is. So if you take a picture with your iPhone camera, typically it's a red, blue, green image. So we can plot that each pixel in red, blue, and green space. So our object will have, will be in that 3D space, you know, according to the response of those variables. But then PC will then create a new image. It transposes or moves that 3D space into a single space, and that space is composed of the variance between those variables. So that helps us understand the information contained in the image. It also allows us to model the noise in the image. And then PSLR will take that information along with the metal concentration information and continue to do relationships between two. Okay, so I think I skipped a slide. Could you go forward on the slide? Okay, next slide, please.
So did you want me to go backwards or forward?
No, yeah, perfect. That's where you are. I'm sorry. That's the slide I wanted. Okay, so I'll just go back through this again. We have an object in red, blue, and green space. It's mapped out on three different variable planes, and a principal component would then compresses that, transposes that information into a single image that is composed of the variance of those three variables. So that's a PC. So the PSLR will continue that analysis with the addition of the column that contains the metal concentration as determined by XRF or other techniques. Okay, next slide, please. So again, PSLR maximizes the covariance between X and Y, that is the spectral information and the metal concentration information determined by any analytical technique. And in this case, the convergence of the system to residual error is achieved in fewer factors than traditional principal components regression. And then this plot shows the procedure. So we have three different component spaces, and we extract the scores and the loadings from that, and then we incorporate the metal information into that, and we create an association between those using one or more Y variables, meaning that multiple Y responses can be used during the regression modeling, and that's the key to the PSLR technique. Next slide, please. So at the end of the process, we have a series of loading factors. So this is an example of work that we did in California where we took in a mine site a number of samples using an airborne imaging spectrometer, and we also had XRF data for those same spots, and I'll go through that a little bit more in a moment. But the loading factors are used to understand the variability and the information contained in that. And in this plot, we're showing that we're getting, you know, agreement of 50% or better for iron and selenium, but for arsenic, it's a little bit lower. And this is a way that we analyze the data in the chemometrics PSLR method. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, for this study, we used NASA's JPL's Avarice imaging system. It's an aircraft-based imaging spectrometer that has a pixel resolution of 4.5 meters. So each pixel is a little less than 5 meters, which is high resolution for this type of system. It's hard to see, but the parameters and values for the instrument are shown. We're going from just basically the 400 nanometers, which is the beginning of the human visible, all the way out to shortwave infrared. And we used XRF measurements obtained by EPA Superfund to train the PSLR technique. So this is, it was flown on a King Air aircraft. And here's a map of the sites. It's east of Sacramento. This is called the Motherlode Mining Belt in California. And we covered a large area of this with the imaging system. Next slide, please. So this is what the images look like. This is near Argonaut Mine, which is undergoing a lot of work from the Superfund program. And then we can zoom in on Argonaut and see where it is on the landscape, the cities around it, and dead center in the middle of that close-up is the actual mine itself. Next slide, please. So here we have a map of the XRF measurements obtained from field sampling. And on the other, we have the Avarice image. So in each pixel where we collected XRF measurements, we're now taking spectral measurements using the Avarice system. So in these areas, we're creating the training set that we're going to use to explore the image in general. Next slide, please. So this is what the spectra looks like for a subset of those sampling points. The spectra itself looks a little crazy compared to a lab-based spectrometer, but you have to understand that there's atmosphere between the sensor and the ground, so that creates some noise in the data. We can model that out to a large extent. There's also scattering in the atmosphere from small particles. There's aircraft noise and vibration. There's other perturbations in the spectra. We can model some of that out, but if you do that too much, then you start to remove some of the spectral features that the PSLR technique is going to use to build its relationships. But we move the water vapor and we model out some of the atmospheric dust and small particles from the spectra before we process it. Next slide, please. So here is the result, preliminary result from the subset of data. Across those sample sets is our training data. We're finding that we can get almost a 0.6 R squared from that analysis, and this is for arsenic. So this technique is, again, a statistical technique. It's not a mineralogical or physical-based technique. So we, in a sense, this is a little bit of a black box technique. We don't know what part of the spectra is informing the PSLR results. I could go into great detail on how we would do it in other methods, but this chemometrics technique is showing good promise to screen areas that are potentially contaminated, and then we can do further analysis using other techniques to refine the results. Next slide, please. So here we have results from other elements. So a lot of iron oxides in the sample pixels. So our R squared for iron is particularly pretty high for that. Also, there's a lot of sulfur too. So this is mine drainage, or not mine drainage material, but mine waste material. So there's a lot of sulfur and selenium and other compounds in there. And this technique was able to get good results for that. We're still working on the arsenic. It's a little harder element to model up and understand. So I want to talk a little bit about what's coming up in the future for using imaging spectroscopy, and now you know some techniques to use with it as far as PSLR and others, but you need the data to do the analysis. So there's drone companies, Precision Hawk, based in Research Triangle Park area where I'm from, has a drone system that we've used in Utah. Other companies have airborne services. Right now, there is a few satellites on orbit and more coming, and that's going to provide us with a large amount of access to data that's collected by satellite systems typically is lower cost because you don't have to deploy an aircraft or a drone. You pay several thousand dollars for a satellite image. It's cheap compared to flying an aircraft. And some of these systems coming online will have similar spatial resolution between 1 and 8 meters. So when you're looking at large areas of the landscape, 1 to 8 meter spatial resolution is very, very good and can provide a large amount of information. So two or three examples of these companies are Orbital Sidekick, Spectral High Spec IQ, and Pixel Space. Pixel Space just launched a satellite a month ago. It's a demonstration satellite, and EPA is working with them on a couple sites to see what utility it has for our work out in different mine sites in the West. So how to access this data? For those of in the audience that are federal civil agency or DOD or organizations under contract, the National Economist, I'm way behind. Could you I'm moving with one system and then I have my phone. So again, just really quick, for federal civil agencies, these different companies will be coming online. We have UAV systems, we have satellite providers. So how to access an order? Again, National Reconnaissance Office has a new multi-vendor contract called the Electro-Optical Commercial Layer. So next month, I believe we'll be able to start accessing this contract. It's a 10-year multi-million dollar contract that allows civil agencies, the DOD, and organizations under contract to acquire data such as High-Spec IQ and other companies. So it's at no cost to the civil and the DOD, and hopefully it'll allow us to use satellite imagery, imaging spectrometer satellite imagery, to meet some of the requirements that we have in the remediation community and other areas such as Superfund. And for people that are EPA, the next slide will have a team member from the geospatial support team that we're working with to help acquire some of this data. So any questions or comments that's regarding the slide deck? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, David. We did have a number of questions that came in. I think in the interest of time, I'm just going to do one, but we may come back to you later. So we'll take one quick question now. One of the attendees wanted to know, is there a limit to the detection of trace elements?
So that's one of the questions we're trying to answer in this. So you notice one of the slides I showed was for iron and sulfur. So in these samples, there's a really high concentration, obviously, in iron oxides and iron hydroxysulfates, but the trace elements are low. So we're seeing probably at the parts per million level, 100 to 200 parts per million is probably what we're thinking is going to be reasonable with this technique. So this is presented as a screening method for large areas, hundreds of acres area, where you're trying to find the hot spots, you're trying to find areas that need to be further investigated. So using this technique, we can screen large areas of landscape and find areas of contamination. But for the lower levels, we might need to do some additional work. So again, we're not at the low parts per million. We're probably at the hundreds of parts per million sensitivity.
All right, excellent. I think just JP, I'm going to send it back to you to introduce our next speaker in the interest of time. Thank you so much, David. We may come back to you shortly, though.
Thank you. Our last speaker, not least, is Dr. Heather Henry. Since 2006, Dr. Henry has been a program administrator for the NIEHS Superfund Research Program in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Her responsibility include administration of the SRP Multi-Project Center Grant, the SRP Individual Research Project Grant, and a Small Business Technology Transfer Grant. She earned a bachelor's degree in biological science at the University of Rochester, a PhD in biological science at the University of Cincinnati, and complete a full breed fellowship at the University of Melbourne and the University of Adelaide in Australia. Today, his presentation is titled Overview of NIEHS Project Applying Machine Learning to Support Remediation Decision. Welcome, Dr. Henry. The floor is yours.
Thank you, I appreciate it. And as a FRTR steering committee member, I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to give a little overview of the ongoing research. So this is going to be a lot more in the early stage, but sometimes it's nice to hear about the research that's up and coming. So that's what I'll be doing, is sharing work that NIEHS Superfund Research Program is doing in the area of machine learning and artificial intelligence. And the Superfund Research Program, we have a wide variety of mandates from Congress looking at health effects, risk, detection technologies, and remediation technologies, all for hazardous substances in the environment. And we really try to take an integrated approach. So not only this health and engineering science, but also research translation, community engagement, training, and very much in line with what we've heard a lot today, data science, data sharing, data integration. So we have artificial intelligence and machine learning being applied in all of the areas, all of our mandate areas, and particularly with regard to that data science connection. Of course, I'm going to focus on what we're doing in the detection and remediation framework, generally falling under four categories. So it's being applied for contaminant detection, gene and enzyme discovery, materials design and optimization, and geospatial ecosystem level information. So drawing from a lot of what we'd heard not only today, but also last week. And we do fund several different mechanisms. And so as a program officer, I'm not the person doing the research, but we certainly help facilitate this happen through the research process. So generally in the MLAI portfolio, we're seeing that work being done by our multi-project center grants, our individual research grants, and our small business grants, and I encourage you to follow the links to find out more about those grantees. So again, I'm just going to give a quick overview of the type of science that's happening. Lots of links are hyperlinked from these slides, and so you can find more information that way. One of our, in terms of the detection technologies, one of our SBIR grantees developed a microfluidics-based biosensor that uses special sensor strains that fluoresce when a specific target is present, and they're working with metals and other water contaminants. And they've used customized optics and imaging processing to then pull in machine learning and train these algorithms to understand to recognize the type and concentration of contaminants in a given water system. And one of our newer projects is through the Baylor College of Medicine Center grant, with work being done at Rice University. And what they're doing is they've developed a biomimetic polymer that sticks to PAHs and PACs. And that polymer then binds to a nanomaterial that can then be read through Raman spectroscopy, basically. And so the machine learning aspect is that the SIRS bound materials can then be trained to learn to recognize the concentration of PAHs. And the really nice thing about this platform is that it's ultra sensitive. You can analyze several analytes at the same time, and there's no need for separation and there's no need for separation and purification steps. Okay, so moving on to gene and enzyme discovery, at University of California, San Diego, Julian Schroeder has been working with Arabidopsis and metal uptake into the plant for quite a number of years, and has really moved into the computational space. And one thing that they developed is a 2 million genome-wide artificial microRNA, which predicts the gene signal transduction pathways and mechanisms that are part of the metal uptake process. So this can be helpful to manipulate for other plant systems and just identify how to enhance and improve phytoremediation or phytoextraction activities. And so one example was recently published how they were able to use this tool, this database for a sedum plant. And the database is fully available online for anyone interested in looking into that. Microbial Insights has presented here in the FRTR several times. One of the projects that they're working on is adapting metabolome data to understand and make a diagnosis of a site, how well it's performing, understand if the site has characteristics that it is showing active degradation or whether it might be stalling. And so one of their computational approaches is to do a test at a site and then give an analysis that shows, well, where is this site falling along all the data that we're seeing at many different sites, you know, particularly for chlorinated contamination remediation. So this is helpful as a tool to inform decisions about site to understand if you're headed for degradation or stalling. And then one of our newer projects is part of our material science and bioremediation research program. We actually had a presentation in April about this, but what the team is doing is using molecular modeling and quantum chemistry to really understand the PFAS surface and PFAS enzyme interactions. And this is being done in conjunction with a polishing step for a graphene metal nanoparticle degradation. So they're trying to predict what enzymes will be helpful for breaking down those smaller PFAS components. And then another one of our R01 grantees, again, working at the bioremediation and material science interface, are the folks at Florida State University and Texas Tech. And they're looking more in the CVOC and 1,4-dioxane world. What they're doing is developing mathematical models to help guide the development of specific tailored macrocyclic sorbents. And this will be used to gain insight into the binding mechanisms of 1,4-dioxane in support of its degradation in the environment. And we also have another small business grantee who's been working on a computational approach that touches on the geospatial and ecosystem level information. They've developed EnviroABM. The ABM stands for agent-based modeling. And what it does is it predicts interactions between microbial ecosystems and hazardous groundwater contaminants. And they've modeled this system for PFCs, VOCs, and other heavy metals. And the last example I'll give is with one of our trainees is going to be doing, or is in the process of doing, a collaborative project with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And Luisa Feliciano is a part of the Northeastern Center and was successful in requesting a special award to focus in on using artificial intelligence and machine learning to understand patterns of groundwater flow in Puerto Rico. Her postdoctoral work is to be looking at karst systems in Puerto Rico. And so it's very difficult to understand the flow of groundwater through these systems. So what they'll be doing is applying AI and ML to get a better sense of how the impacts of Hurricane Maria. We look forward to hearing how that goes. So that was just a snapshot. JP, you see, is a very, very short overview of the work that we're doing. We certainly appreciate having the opportunity to hear the other presentations and certainly want to by no means make the impression that we are the only federal agency doing this work. I did look up at USA spending, and of course the Department of Defense is investing quite a bit in this landscape, as well as EPA. So we're just one of the players out there, one of many players, but certainly thank you for this very interesting session And I'm available, I think, to follow up afterwards if anybody has questions. So I'll pass it back to you, JP. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather. So, Jean, do we have time for open discussion?
I think we do. So, JP, I know that there were some questions that came in earlier for some of the other speakers. Would you like me to start with just a few of those and then we'll turn the floor up?
Okay. Sure.
All right. I know that we may have lost some of our speakers from earlier, so I'm going to scroll through here and just confirm and see if I have one here. I'm scrolling through here, and I'm going to go back to David, if you're still with us on the phones. David, if you'd like to hit star 6 and unmute.
Yes, right. I'm here.
Excellent. Okay, David. So we did have someone who asked if there was an impact of moisture in atmospheric pollution on spectral instruments.
So definitely the atmospheric moisture is a big influence on the spectra. So if we're out west where in Nevada, where we were just at, that's a great place for imaging spectroscopy. There's not a lot of atmospheric water vapor, but out east there is. So we have to use atmospheric correction techniques to remove the influence of water vapor from the spectra. So there's ModTran and some other tools that we use that will remove the influence of water vapor and specific wavelength ranges from the data. If there's any spectral information of our target material in those water vapor bands, that's lost, of course, but that's just a function of the technique. So atmospheric pollutants, if you're thinking about things in the atmosphere like methane, these systems can map methane in the atmosphere. It has a distinct absorption feature in the spectra. I'm not sure if the question is referring to atmospheric pollutants or things like nitrates or sulfates on the surface of the Earth. That would be a different question.
Okay. Okay, related to this, can the spectral scanning show anything other than metals on the surface? They specifically wondered if you could detect methane or carbon dioxide.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I think I just mentioned that. So methane has an absorption feature in the spectral range of our instrument. So we can see methane. We can map hotspots. We can map to a point from the emission point. So we can't measure ambient background methane, but we can map areas where the methane concentration is higher than the ambient background. So like leaks or seeps, we can see in the data. Carbon dioxide is just so much of it that we actually model that out. So in our system, but there are instruments that can be used for high concentrations of CO2. Similar to methane, it's not useful for ambient measurements. It's another instrument that does that. But if you're looking at, for example, like a CO2 leak from a cap, well cap system or something, you can see that in the data with our instruments.
Okay. What I'm going to do now is actually pull up our member agency announcements. We were going to play these during a brief break, but we unfortunately ran a little bit short on time for that brief break. So while these are up on the screen, JP, I wanted to turn it over to you to see if there was anything that you wanted to pose or share with the audience before we close things out today.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I do have a question. I don't know if we still have SRNL, like Karen or Dr. Thomas online?
It looks like they dropped off.
Okay, well, one of my questions, and maybe they can follow up later on, is on lesson learned along the way. For example, I know that Dr. Thomas showed a presentation where he's showing a sensor installation wellhead modified. I'm just curious if those modifications are being done after they reach out, or on the design, is this something that it come along the way, or how they capture the lesson learned? So maybe for the record, we can write down and follow sure. up on that.
Yes, we can bring that back to them for sure.
Yeah. And then at this time, are we doing the closing, Jean?
Yes, we certainly can.
Okay, good. So we come to the end of today's presentation. We would like to thank all of the presenters for their informative and interesting discussion, and to the audience for their active participation. We hope the presentation will be beneficial for all of you. Feel free to reach out via the FRTR webpage if you like to provide any feedback or submit topics for any future event. With this, I would like to close this event. Back to you, Jean.
All right, thank you so very much. I'm gonna swap a few things around here on my end and walk through a few final reminders for our live audience before we close things out today. Now, unfortunately, we ran a bit short on time today and we weren't able to showcase all of the member agency announcements during our break here, but we did show those in session number one, and we will have copies of those announcements available to download along with the presentation materials. So if you didn't see the full loop or didn't join us for session one, you can access these announcements from the presentation links that I'll be pointing everyone to here in just a moment. So I'm going to swap out our view here and walk through our final reminders for our session before we close things out today. So I do want to thank everyone who joined us, and I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org. And important to note, we have a number of ways to stay connected, specifically a monthly newsletter called Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month, where we'll highlight free online sessions and other online resources related to hazardous waste remediation and characterization. So if you're not a subscriber, I highly encourage you to sign up for Tech Direct today. If you're looking for copies of the presentation materials and information about both speaker sets for the two different sessions, you'll find it on the seminar homepage. That's the same homepage you went when registering. It is the same homepage where you went when checking in. And it is that same URL that's shown here on red at the top of the slide. So that URL is valid from today forward. If you happen to be replaying the webinar, you can still visit that URL to access the materials. So as I noted, we'll have presentation materials, and again, our member agency announcements will be available there as well. And I will ask you all to take just a moment to share your thoughts following today's session using our online feedback form. I oftentimes get questions about CEUs or PDHs, and while I cannot issue those types of credit hours, I can provide you with a participation certificate if you complete that online feedback form. Now, in order to receive one of those certificates, please be sure that you fill out the feedback form and check the box at the very bottom certifying you were here for the entire session. And then as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll then have an option to download a certificate, or we'll also email a copy to you. Just note, sometimes spam filters and junk folders can catch that email, so it's always a good idea to download it right from the confirmation screen when you're done submitting your feedback. One of the other things to note, the organizers would love to have your input on topics for future FRTR meetings. So when you're filling out that feedback form, please be sure to include those thoughts in the notes or comments section. And then, of course, if there were multiple people joining at your location, each person can fill out that feedback form to get their own certificate, even if they didn't register individually. I kindly ask that the person who did register and set up the session just get a link to that feedback form and share it with those who joined you. Today's session was recorded just like the first one in the series, and you'll automatically get an email when the archive is available for on-demand playback. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still fill out feedback on that form online and then get a participation certificate based off your replay of the session. So right about now, somewhere above my head in the online recorded version, there will be a link to that feedback form. So I encourage you to click that, share your thoughts, and then again, check the box to certify you replayed the whole thing to get your own certificate. So with that, I want to thank all of the FRTR member agencies, the steering committee, all of our speakers, and all of the participants who joined us for both sessions. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you'll join us on a future session. Thank you so very much for joining us.